10 years ago, a television phenomenon became a part of life, shared in 47 different languages, read in 469 publications, and seen by 1.2 billion people. A common experience remembered around the world. Now Paramount Pictures brings the memory to life. Star Trek, the motion picture, rated G.
You think your world is safe? It is an illusion. Enjoy these final moments of peace.
By now, all of you have heard what happened in London. The man who did it is one of our top agents.
Your commanders have committed a crime I cannot forgive. None of you are safe.
I am better.
At what?
Everything.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is J.J. Abrams' Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness. Discuss these two films with me is Midnight Entertainment's own Jim Yelton. Welcome aboard the White Rocket, Jim.
Hey, thanks, man.
Jim is another one of our returning champions from earlier in the series. We had a great two-part conversation about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think down the road we're planning on doing the DC Cinematic Universe. Is that not correct?
Yeah, I think we're going to wait until after Man of Steel comes out, and we'll hit that one. That's going to be cool.
Awesome, yeah. Jim is a writer, a publisher, a director. He is involved in virtually every level of the creation of entertainment. He's a good friend of mine, and I'm always glad to have him on the show. And we both are Star Trek fans to one degree or another, and we both have pretty strong opinions about the new Abrams Star Trek movie and the two, you know, the Star Trek reboot and now Into Darkness. But we haven't really compared notes, so I think this is going to be very interesting for me and for Jim as well as for you, the listener, because Jim and I both think we kind of know what each other thinks, but it's going to be interesting to find out if that's the case. All right, so this is going to be a voyage of discovery for us. Hopefully it won't be 5 years, more like about an hour, so hopefully everybody will enjoy it. Now, let me give out the spoiler warning. We're going to talk about every detail, at least every detail I can remember, of one from 4 years ago. So if you haven't seen one or both of these movies, it's up to you. You're on your own. You have been warned. Jim, can you believe that it's been 4 years since the reboot?
You know, what's really weird is that I hadn't even thought about it in terms of 4 years until just the other day when I was looking stuff up, getting ready for the show. Just because to me, I decided early on, because I saw the reboot Star Trek when it first came out. I actually saw it twice the same day on opening day. And I hadn't seen it for an entire year since then. And I started making it like my Thanksgiving tradition. So it's funny because I've actually only seen it a handful of times. And I like that I've only seen it a handful of times. Because it's not like it's overkill for me. It's like I haven't sat down and watched it 42 times on cable.
Right.
You know, I've caught it here and there when it's been on cable. But for the most part, it's just been like once a year, I'll sit down and watch it. And I love the first one and was really excited when Into Darkness came out. So it did kind of surprise me when I sat down and thought, you know, that it, 4 years had gone by.
Was there something that now we're going to get into each one of the two Abrams films very in depth and specifically in just a minute, but did something happen that delayed it? Because somebody, I was hearing somebody saying that this movie was supposed to come out in 2011.
Yeah, it actually was. And I don't know exactly what the behind the scenes deal was. I know Abrams was kind of busy doing some stuff, and they kept saying they wanted to get the script right. And that was the one thing I kept hearing the couple of times they delayed it, was that they really wanted to make sure that they had the script as good as it can be before they shot it, because they didn't want to just rush it out just to do a sequel for it. So I think that was the big thing, was that everybody involved behind the scenes just wanted it to be as good as possible.
Right. And but I mean, it's a 4 year wait. I mean, I can't think of, I know there've been some, but I can't think of many franchises that have gone that long, especially after the first one, maybe between like the second and third or third and fourth. But you know, the Star Wars movies, when I was a kid, it seemed like an eternity between them. And that was only 3 years. Yeah.
And that's why I was kind of surprised when they pushed it back a year, because I thought they're going to lose some momentum that they had built up from the first one. I mean, they got a lot of goodwill, not just from the fan base, but kind of from like non-fans. And I thought they've got to strike while the iron's hot here and have another sequel come out to take advantage.
Yeah. And I think there's no doubt that did sort of happen, because it really did seem to disappoint the studio with its, with the release money. The 18 day total is 10 million off of the first one. I don't think the first one was a huge financial hit, at least immediately. It was more of a like, oh, a surprising thing, as opposed to, you know, hang your hat on this franchise when they rebooted it. And it's, I think to some degree, kind of gotten swamped in the wake of Iron Man 3 being such a huge hit.
Yeah. And I was kind of worried about that when, you know, I'm one of those people that looks at release schedules, just because I'm trying to look at more of the business side of some of this stuff. Uh-huh. And so when I see the summer release schedule and I see, well, it's not coming out as early as the first one came out, and it's in the wake of Iron Man 3, and there's other stuff coming out. And I, you know, I hate to say this, but you know, much as I'm not a fan of the Fast and Furious franchise, I knew that was going to be huge. And I just kept thinking, okay, you know, Star Trek's going to kind of get like washed away here when, you know, some other stuff comes along. So, you know, I'm interested to see if it has legs throughout the summer and can actually, you know, get close to what the original's total was.
Yeah, they really did sort of wedge it in between two big box office movies there. And my thoughts on Iron Man, we'll be going into, I think Bobby Polite and I are going to do a show in a few days where you can all hear how I felt about that. let's see. All right. So I think the first thing we need to do is sort of address Star Trek in general. I've never considered myself either a Trekkie or Trekker. But on the other hand, I started watching Star Trek when I was about 8 years old, and I've followed it very closely, and it's always had a special place in my heart. It's never been my favorite thing. but it's always been one of my, you know, sort of favorite things. So first up, I think let's look at why we like Trek in general, but where does the Trek franchise, the whole Trek property, where does it kind of place in your heart as terms of entertainment?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think if you asked people that knew me growing up or know me now, I think there are a lot of people that would say he's a Star Wars guy.
Mm.
And the more and more I think about it, I mean, I loved Star Wars as a kid because that was the big thing for us at the time.
Sure.
But I think I've always been more of a Star Trek person. And it's weird thinking about that because Star Wars was such a big part of my life growing up. But for me, I mean, I can remember as a kid watching Star Trek and reruns. And that was kind of where I think you and I parallel as far as our intro into Star Trek. It was always, you know, when it hit syndication in the 70s and we were able to watch it every night,
yeah.
You know, we were getting a lot of Star Trek all at once and yeah. instead of having to wait a week at a time to watch it. And then, you know, the movies came along. So, you know, Star Trek's always been something that I was just like drawn to. And I loved not just the idea and the basic premise, but the characters are one of the things that I think really draws people in. And it was really one of the first franchises that kind of took advantage of having books and other spinoffs and all this ancillary stuff
yeah.
that kind of expanded the universe. I mean, you know, if you think about how we think about Kirk and Spock and McCoy and the relationships of the crew, a lot of that came out of stuff that wasn't in the original series mm-hmm. that we as fans just kind of put on there, or it was expanded on in all of the books that started coming out in the wake of the movies. So, you know, I've always been fascinated by kind of that crew relationship and the characters. And I think that's one of the things that kind of tips it for me is that it's much more of a relationship kind of a thing than Star Wars was. Star Wars was much more plot driven.
Yeah.
And Star Trek was much more about these characters being presented with a dilemma and they had to kind of work together to figure out how to get out of it.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting. You touched on something there that I hadn't really thought about before, because for some reason we all have kind of been conditioned to think of Star Wars as almost the first property to have a big toy and book line. But Star Trek, I remember having Star Trek action figures before Star Wars came out. I can remember having Star Trek books before Star Wars came out. The 12 volumes that James Blish,
yep.
novelized the entire series, 3 or 4 or 5 episodes per book. Those all came out right before Star Wars. And the log books that Alan Dean Foster did of the animated series were coming out around that time. Because I remember seeing them in the kids section in the library when I was a little kid before Star Wars. And I had like the Mego Captain Kirk. And I had the bridge. I had the bridge set. With the transporter, you push the button on the top and it spun around and all
spun
that.
Spun around, yep.
I had all that. Yeah, man. I wish I had it now. I could pay the mortgage for a couple of months. But it really was a pioneer in that way to a certain degree. And people kind of forget in the wake of Star Wars just what Star Trek really was kind of doing in the popular culture consciousness of that period. You were getting I just talked to Joe Haldeman at Archon, you know, just a few months ago in St. Louis up in Collinsville. And we were talking about, you know, he wrote 2 of the very first Star Trek novels ever, mm-hmm. Planet of Judgment and World Without End. And I still had my 2 copies from the from back when I was a kid. I got him to sign them. But that was well before anything else really, I guess, to a certain degree, had anything like that going on.
Yeah. And it always amazes me when I think about, as you know, we're going through the process of creating things and writing, and it always amazes me how a property like Star Trek has had so much fan interaction, and the characters have grown because of the fans and what we want them to be, not necessarily what Roddenberry thought in that initial first season of creating the show. And we'll get into it with the movies a little bit here in a bit, but that to me has been the thing that has always drawn me to it. It's like, I want to see these characters getting into some action situation and see how they get out of it. Yeah. And I've kind of imprinted myself on the characters and what I want from them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's an excellent point. And I also think that, and I think this is very important that it be stated up front. I have to say this up front. Before we talk about Abrams, the listeners need to know where I'm coming from as a Star Trek fan. And that is that what I appreciate about Star Trek, what I have always appreciated about Star Trek, is that it was not a frenetic action adventure show. It had elements of adventure and had elements mm-hmm. of action, just like, you know, any explorers have as they go out in the wilderness. But this was not, the thing that was paramount, no pun intended, about Star Trek to me was that it was not that the science was necessarily realistic, but that it was a show that emphasized science and reason and logic, right? And rationality. Humans were presented as just about as powerful and as advanced as anybody they encountered. They were on a par with most of what they encountered, unless it was some really freakish thing like V'ger or something. They were usually, you know, it's not like they were. We talked about this at Birmingham at Alabama Phoenix Festival last week at a Star Trek panel I was on and we also talked about it on the Space 1999 show that in Space 1999 humans are ants, and every menace that they faced on Space 1999 was a god looking at ants, whereas on Star Trek humans were the gods. Humans had gone out into space and had assumed a godlike role. The Prime Directive shows that they were like gods and could alter planets if they wanted to, and had to choose not to be malevolent gods, right? Not to be interfering gods. And so because of that, Star Trek always took a very thoughtful, measured approach. That's one of the things that's so great about Captain Kirk, is that he is a part of that system, and yet he has the capacity to be a man of action, to be a throwback, kind of a Buck Rogers in the 25th century, right, when he needs to be.
Yep.
Kirk can be a measured, thoughtful person, but he can also be the guy that says, screw it, let's blow them all up, you know, and that's kind of a thing that's needed in that environment.
Right, and since we're kind of setting the stage for the conversation we're going to have about the reboot, you know, one of the things that always attracted me to Star Trek was that it very consciously, with the original characters, had that triumvirate of Kirk and Spock and McCoy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, much has been written and much has been discussed about how, you know, Spock was logic, and McCoy was kind of like the humanist, you know, heartfelt thinking of us, mm-hmm. not the aliens who were all logical. And Kirk was kind of caught in between those two. Mm-hmm. And so he could be logical when he needed to be, but he was also very emotional with decisions he made at times. And the whole first three seasons of the show, you see the discussion and you see those three characters working their way through situations. And it's almost a debate for the whole three seasons mm-hmm. of which way's right. Is logic right or is emotion right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the ultimate winner is Kirk, because he's basically there saying, well, they're both right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, I can be a man of action if I need to be, but I can also pull it back and do something logical and, you know, the quote unquote smart thing to do at times.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that makes the character of James T. Kirk so appealing, is that he bridges that divide between the two sort of intellectual and emotional realms. And that's one of the things that I've been somewhat disappointed in both the movies from like 79 through the 80s, right? And also this new set of movies, is that Kirk at his best, you know, he's the way Roddenberry envisioned him. I always say he is John F. Kennedy. He's JK. James mm-hmm. Kirk is John F. Kennedy on a USS ship flying around the galaxy, dealing with the Klingons, the Russians, the Romulans, the Chinese. You know, it's the Cold War in space, and Kirk is JFK. He's even got the haircut. Seeing Chris Pine in the new one, he has the JFK haircut even more than Kirk did.
Oh, yeah.
Even
yeah,
more
he
than
does.
Shatner. And so, and see, this is the thing that frustrates me, is that the two new movies keep – well, let's start. The old movies, the William Shatner toupee movies, right, that was Kirk having become an admiral, and they have to contrive ways to get him back to being what he is so good at, his first best destiny. These new movies, they're so early that he's not yet that. He's still dealing right. with that. And so I just want Kirk to be Kirk. I'm tired of old Kirk, and I'm tired of young Kirk. I want Kirk.
Well, and I got to be honest with you, because I've been watching the original series on a regular basis over the last year. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. You know, there's a part of me, and you know, Shatner gets a lot of grief and takes a lot of crap for his overacting in the later movies, and that he's kind of become a parody of himself. But if you look at his performance as Kirk in the original series, I mean, it's a great television performance. As yeah. is, you know, pretty much the whole cast. Yeah. But, you know, he's the epitome of what you want somebody in that position to be. And I feel the same way that you do. Like, there's parts of me when I watch the original cast and the movies that I'm like, man, I mean, that's he gets to be Captain Kirk. And he gets to be the guy that we all like. And then there's other times where I'm like, oh, wow, I don't want to listen to him whine about getting old or make fun of being old or, you know, being out of touch or not having a ship or whatever.
Right.
And I felt the same way going into the new movies. It's like I was kind of weary of old Kirk. And I wanted Chris Pine to give me the Kirk that I had in the original series. Which right. was the guy that knew what to do, that didn't vacillate from that, that didn't hem and haw. It was just like, I mean, this is the guy that did the Corbomite maneuver, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he bluffed an alien of immense power and got away with it. I want that guy.
Right. Well, I like to some degree what Chris Pine does, what he brings to the table, but it has yet to feel authentic to me, I guess, in some way. I had more to say, but I'll have to get back around to it. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get into if it comes to me, I'll say it. Let's go ahead and get into the Abrams films now. What they had done, you know, for a while Star Trek was overexposed. It was just I remember. I got to tell the story. I remember the story I was going to tell, which was my favorite story about Shatner overacting, was that it may have been like Nicholas Meyer, Harvey Bennett, whoever was the director on like the second one, or you know, whatever it was, you know, because they started, Shatner and Nimoy started directing themselves, you know, later on.
Nicholas Meyer did the second one. Which...
Yeah, that may have been it. It's in one of those books. He says that Shatner was overacting so much that what he started doing was doing like six or seven takes, because he knew that by the sixth or seventh take, Shatner would be so worn down that he couldn't overact anymore. And they'd always use the last take. He'd be calmed down by then, you know, he'd be settled down and they could use it. So I just thought that was funny. All right. So the Abrams films, it had been really overexposed. You'd had, you know, in quick succession, we'd gone from The Next Generation to Deep Space Nine to Voyager to Enterprise. And it was just too much Star Trek. And I was saying at that time, they really needed to do what Star Wars did, which is make people miss it. Because, you know, yep. after Return of the Jedi, there was a period from about 1983 to 1991 where there was just nothing Star Wars, except maybe the Marvel comic. And it wasn't until about 91 that you got the first of the new novels, the Timothy Zahn, you know, trilogy. And that was really promoted, you know, as a big thing. And so it made people miss it. And that sort of ramped up toward the re-releases of the original three movies in the mid to late 90s. So I said, Star Trek just needs to go away for about 5 years. Just let us forget about it for a while and miss it. And it kind of did. And then in 2009, we got the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie called something no Star Trek movie had ever been called before, which was...
It was just Star Trek, amazing to me.
Yeah, Star Trek. That was it. No motion picture, no nothing, right? So it was quite a shock to me because this is something I meant to mention earlier, is that where I'm coming from, brace yourself, Jim, my favorite Star Trek movie of all is Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Now, see, I don't have a problem with somebody saying that that's their favorite because – hindsight being 2020 and, you know, being a little bit older now,
yes.
Every time I watch that, that is the most like the original series of any of the movies.
Yes. Yes.
And it actually does what you kind of want a movie adaptation of a TV series to do, which is take the TV series premise and just make it bigger mm-hmm. and bolder and a movie. It's kind of like, you know, I look at The Fugitive every time I watch it. The Fugitive is a 2-hour long version of the TV series, mm-hmm. but the action beats are bigger. The emotional beats are bigger. The characterization's a little bit more in depth. And that's what Star Trek The Motion Picture does mm-hmm. is it gives you the grand ideas and the grand logic versus emotion debates of the original series on a big screen. And I actually have warmed over the years to the motion picture, and I think it gets a lot of flack that it shouldn't.
When I was younger, Trek II, Wrath of Khan was my favorite. And there's a lot about it I still love. But in the last few years, something has happened, which is Robert Wise's director's cut came out, and it addressed in very strong fashion the two problems that I had with Star Trek the Motion Picture. Number one, of all the movies or TV shows where they've gone back and redone the special effects, I would argue there is no single movie or TV show that more desperately needed the special effects redone than Star Trek the Motion Picture, because the effects in that movie of the Enterprise were okay, but the V'ger effects were terrible. They were they were muddy, and you couldn't ever tell what was going on. It was like trying to watch a movie through really tinted sunglasses. And what they did was they redid all the V'ger effects so that you can actually tell what's going on. And the other thing they needed to do, they needed to cut it down and make it tighter. And they did that. So a much tighter, much better visual affected motion picture, I just fell in love with it all over again. So I say that to say that the new Star Trek movie, 2009 Star Trek, was the complete opposite of that.
I couldn't believe it when the bartender told me who you are.
Why are you talking to me, man?
Your father was captain of a starship for 12 minutes. He saved 800 lives. Including yours. I dare you to do better. Enlist in Starfleet.
You will experience fear.
Fear in the face of certain death.
Pull your chute! Go, 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 go!
We received a distress call.
I've been waiting for this day my whole life. This day of reckoning.
got no captain and no first officer to replace him.
Yeah, we do.
You are capable of deciding your own destiny. The question is, which path will you choose?
James T. Kirk was a great man, but that was another life.
They're locking torpedoes.
Emergency evasive!
Fire everything!
It's just, you know, cut loose, out of the blocks, start to finish. And yet I really liked it when it came out. I really liked it. What did you think of it when it first came out?
I loved it. I mean, I said earlier, I saw it twice on opening day. I mean, I saw it the first showing, and then about 4 or 5 hours later, I saw it again with my dad. Mm-hmm. And I was just blown away by it. And I didn't go into it. I mean, I've liked some stuff that J.J. Abrams did previous, but I wasn't a quote-unquote J.J. Abrams fan. You know, I wasn't a huge Lost fan. So, you know, when I knew that that kind of brain trust was doing Star Trek, I was like, oh, this will be interesting. I'm glad it's somebody that's got some clout that can actually take over the franchise. And I had heard the rumblings about what they were going to do as far as how they were going to reboot it. And I kind of liked that because I liked the idea that they, in story, rebooted it instead of just saying, okay, we're just going to show you the beginning adventures of these people when they were younger and we're going to have a new cast play them. I actually liked that there was some internal logic within that universe as to why things were going to change and be different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I liked that they were doing a more action adventure Star Trek, but there was also a part of me that was hoping, okay, we've got to get this out of the way to get the reboot accomplished. And obviously, because that's the biggest priority storytelling wise, it's not going to be a real convoluted plot.
Right.
So let's set the table, and then maybe in the second one we can have something that's more Star Trek.
Right. Right. Well, I really enjoyed it. I had been saying for years that new shows with new crews and new captains, that's all well and good, but I always would say, why not just go back and do the early adventures of the Enterprise with a younger cast playing the same characters, because those characters are who people like. It always seemed as if Paramount had decided that it was the universe people liked and not the characters.
Right.
And I always thought, well, it's the universe is cool, but what about the characters? You know, it's kind of like if after they did Iron Man and Thor and Captain America, they decided, well, instead of doing any more movies with Iron Man, Thor, or Captain America, or the Avengers, let's only do Iron Fist and Daredevil, and then we'll maybe do, you know, Tigra. You know, it's like, don't forget the big characters that made this, and they did that. So I enjoyed it a lot. I didn't think a lot about the plot problems at first. I actually took my wife to see it a couple of days later, and she actually liked it too, which is a rare thing for this kind of thing. And so, yeah, I was totally on board. I felt like it was just reverent enough to the original material, but yet it boldly went where it needed to go to be fresh and original at the same time. So I gave a thumbs up to it.
Yeah, and you mentioned some of the plot problems, and you know, we can talk about that in a second. But I looked at it like my pure enjoyment level was high for it, because all of the plot issues and some of the kind of minor character issues that I had with it didn't keep me from enjoying it. And, you know, it's, I tell the same thing to people about the Avengers. is regardless of what minor issues I may have had with it, I was just like blown away by it so much. And I truly enjoyed the experience of watching it. Mm-hmm. And I felt that way that when I saw the first Star Trek was I enjoyed it so much that I was going to give them a pass on all of the problems I had with it.
Yeah.
And I figured, okay, this is just kind of a table setter. And now with the second one, they've got to show me what they're going to do in this new playground that they've created. So I kind of felt the same way you did. I left the theater both times thinking I would thoroughly recommend this to somebody, whether they liked Star Trek or not.
And it had a really solid cast. I was very impressed with that. I think that that everybody expected Zachary Quinto would be Spock, and that's who we got, and that was all well and good. And it was funny to see. I wasn't really familiar with Chris Pine at first, but I quickly realized he's the son of the sergeant on Chips.
Yep.
And that kind of worked. But obviously and Zoe Saldana and all that. But Simon Pegg. But the real, I think, breakout star that impressed people was Carl Urban. I honestly think that 99.99% of people that saw it originally did not realize that McCoy was the same guy that led the Rohan guys in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, no. And, I mean, you and I knew that because, you know, we're genre guys. But yeah. I guarantee you that most of the non-genre fans that were drawn into it because it was a big event movie had, like, no clue that that was the same guy. And I actually loved his performance in the first movie. I mean, I was like, wow, out of everybody, you know, he is doing the closest DeForest Kelly that he can do without doing DeForest Kelly.
Yeah.
Because I kind of felt like, you know, with the exception of Quinto playing Spock, because they had Nimoy playing old Spock in the same movie.
Yeah.
I felt like they may have told everybody, we don't want you to do an impersonation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of the original cast member. But Carl Urban drew enough of DeForest Kelly into that performance to make me love every time he was on screen.
Yeah, I enjoyed his performance in the 2009 Star Trek, and I would have enjoyed his performance if he had been in the 2013 Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly.
It would have been nice if he'd actually been in that movie a little bit, you know, instead of not.
I think he was in two scenes of the movie, but I'm not 100% sure about both of them.
Yeah, And his little alien. I'm sorry, I'm talking about Scotty now. Let me switch over to Scotty. Simon Pegg was awesome as Scotty, and I'm still trying to figure out his little alien friend because I like the fact that they've just never addressed it, have they?
No, I mean he's just he was there in the first movie with him on the ice planet, and then he just kind of followed him, and they've never explained what the deal is or who he is or what he function he serves other than to give Simon Pegg somebody to yell at.
Yeah. That's just hilarious. It makes no sense at all, but it's pretty funny. And I really like Bruce Greenwood as a sort of a Starfleet guy. He makes a very good, you know, kind of elder statesman, leader, captain, admiral, whatever. And so I've been very pleased with him. The others are really, I mean, John Cho is John Cho. I can't look at him without thinking he's on his way to White Castle and to smoke his pot and eat his burgers, you know. And Anton Yelchin as Chekhov is just there to be a Russian. You know, they could have any Russian with a Chekhov sticker on his chest, basically, I think. I don't know.
And this is where, you know, we're as we start to kind of bridge the gap between the two. In the first one, I felt like, you know, even though, you know, as I said earlier, in the original cast, it was always Kirk and Spock and McCoy, and then kind of everybody else was off to the side. I felt like they did a really good job of setting the table in the first one for, okay, we got a little taste of Sulu. We got a little taste of Chekhov. I thought it was interesting the choice they made to have Uhura and Spock involved in a relationship, because that kind of gave Uhura a little bit more to do character-wise.
Yeah.
Gave her more of a reason to be involved in things.
But does it fit in with the whole Pon Farr deal and Spock only cares about women like once every 7 years or something? I'm that just confuses me.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily that they don't care about women. I think part of it has to do with the fact that you can always say, well, Spock's only half Vulcan. So,
okay.
You know, there's part, but I think that gives them an interesting kind of seed to plant for later on in the series if they want to bring that up. So I thought with the first one, there was a lot of stuff that was obviously, okay, we're going to plant all these seeds and set everything up for future movies in the franchise. We're kind of, and this is something that's really bugging me about the state of movies in general, not just Star Trek, but that people are actually writing movies and not putting all the good stuff in the first movie. You know, I mean, all of the franchises now, it's we have to hold something back because we're going to do 2 and 3 and 4 down the road. And we want to set stuff up, but we don't want to tell you everything in the first movie. And so, you know, there was a lot of little stuff like that, like the her and Spock relationship or the little alien guy that was with Scotty or the fact that we didn't get a lot with Sulu and Chekhov in this first movie. I kind of thought, okay, that's coming up. Like they can expand those characters in the second movie and the third movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other person we didn't mention from the first one that's neat is that that's where we first really got a good look at Thor. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And actually I thought that opening sequence with the Kelvin was really cool for a number of reasons, because that was kind of the first time we saw Chris Hemsworth in any sort of big role. Mm-hmm. I loved that the captain of the Kelvin was the same guy that played kind of the big bad terrorist in the first Iron Man movie, which came out around the same time. So I was like, hey, yeah, that's the bad guy from Iron Man.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. Well, so, all right, so that movie came and went, and we liked it, and I think that a big part of the reason we liked that movie was that Damon Lindelof, or as I like to call him, the Antichrist, he was only a producer at that point. You had Roberto Orci, however you pronounce it, and Alex Kurtzman as the main writers. Now, for Star Trek Into Darkness, we got Lindelof being the guy that gets to do the final draft of the screenplay. And for those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, Damon Lindelof is Abrams' buddy. He was involved on Lost, right?
Yep.
And he's the guy who wrote the final draft of Prometheus. Again, a beautiful, fun movie to look at. Makes no damn sense at all. So, well,
and I think the reason that he didn't do more on the first track was because he was wrapping up Lost. So he wasn't able to spend as much time day to day, but they wanted him involved because he was of that kind of like brain trust. He was the Star Trek guy.
Yeah.
More than anybody else. And so if I remember from interviews with J.J. Abrams, he said like Lindelof was the guy that they would call and say, okay, we're going to do this. Is this going to make a hardcore fan's head explode, or can we do this, or how does it fit into the mythology? Because, you know, again, J.J. Abrams was more of a Star Wars guy growing up. Yeah. And was not as big of a fan of Trek. So it didn't surprise me when they got ready to do the sequel, because Lindelof's schedule had kind of opened up that he was going to take more of a hands-on approach with the screenplay for Into Darkness.
Yeah. Well, so this is really the meat of it here now. What did you think when you first sat there in the theater watching Into Darkness?
What did I think? Mm-hmm. Well, okay, let's approach this from a standpoint of we live in a world full of spoilers now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, you gave the spoiler alert at the beginning of this. So we can talk about the fact that Benedict Cumberbatch plays Khan in this movie.
Yes.
I knew that going in. It wasn't a surprise to me. And normally when I have stuff spoiled for me, it doesn't ruin the experience of the movie. I go into it more of a, I want to see how they do this sort of a mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that he was going to be Khan, I was kind of like, okay, let's see what they do. Let me see how they explain this before I just go crazy and say, why are you guys doing this and ruining this franchise? So I went into it and I liked the first third of the movie.
Yes, yes.
I really liked the opening, which was kind of more of a TV-like teaser than anything, with them on the alien planet and kind of breaking the Prime Directive multiple times. And I liked how they set up kind of the struggle between Kirk and Spock.
Yeah,
I liked the fact that they right off the bat had a situation where Kirk was going to break whatever rules he had to save Spock's life. And in fact, I loved the line. There's an exchange between Kirk and McCoy in, you know, one of the scenes that Carl Urban's actually in the movie, where Kirk says, if Spock were here right now and I was down in the volcano, what would he do? And McCoy says, he'd let you die. And you know immediately Kirk's not going to let him die.
Yeah.
And so that kind of sets up that dynamic. From that point on, like once the terrorist attacks happen on Earth and you know that somebody's kind of going after Starfleet, I was shocked that they killed off Bruce Greenwood as early as they did, because I really liked his portrayal of Pike, and I thought that it was interesting that Pike was around in this timeline where he wasn't around in the original timeline to kind of mentor Kirk. And I liked that, especially since they kind of took away Kirk's father figure really early in the first movie by having his father killed.
Right.
So, like I said, the first third of it I was okay with. Once they captured Benedict Cumberbatch and brought him on the Enterprise, then I started getting iffy with it.
Yeah.
And I didn't really feel good about where it was going, because they gave a reason why this bad guy was doing what he was doing. And then it became a Starfleet's bad sort of a movie.
Yeah.
And now Kirk has to decide, well, how am I going to deal with this? Well, I got to go back and kind of right the wrongs of what Starfleet's been doing. But overall, the thing that totally took me out of the movie was the fact that it was Khan.
Yeah.
And that there was no reason for him to be there, because the explanation is, well, they started exploring the galaxy a little bit faster because of the events of the first movie. They found the Botany Bay and Khan and all of his followers, and some Starfleet admiral decides that it's going to be a good idea to thaw him out so that he can start helping them create weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And that made no sense to me at all. And I know that their explanation, you know, Abrams and company's explanation of this was they were trying to make a statement about living in a post 9/11 world like we do, but that made no sense to me. That they would take some. I mean, clearly everybody would know who Khan was. I mean, in the original series episode in Space Seed,
when they
thaw him out and he says who he is, they look him up, and they look him up on their computer and they know who he is.
Yeah.
So it's not a surprise when he starts to do all of the villainous things that he does. The conflict is, well, he's a Superman, and how does Kirk, who's a normal man, and him and win? And in this, they kind of just like totally threw that out the window. And it was like, well, yeah, I mean, we knew who he was, and we figured he could help us, so that's why we thought him out.
They try to do Space Seed, Wrath of Khan, and something else all at the same time, and it was so rushed. Didn't feel any. It just seemed like they were touching touchstones, going, oh yeah, and here's where this happens. Oh yeah, and here's where this happens, rather than giving us an emotional buildup over time.
Yeah, and that's one of the points that I was going to make about the Kirk-Spock dynamic in this movie, was I really felt like when we had Wrath of Khan come out, mm-hmm. we had a number of years of experiencing the adventures of this crew together.
Right.
So it really felt like when Wrath of Khan came along and you've got Ricardo Montalban kind of coming out of the shadows and being the big bad villain, trying to gain revenge on Kirk, and Spock has to sacrifice himself for the crew. Like, that was really an earned moment. Like, we had been through a lot with this crew.
Yeah.
And I could believe that these people cared about each other deeply. In Into Darkness, they haven't really earned that yet with me, because when Star Trek came out in 09, I said, okay, you know what? If you're rebooting the universe, I'm hitting the reboot button too. And my feelings about these characters have to be rebuilt. Like, I want to see where you're going with this. And McCoy and Kirk are just becoming friends. They're not as close as they were in the original series yet. Kirk and Spock dislike each other. And Spock really dislikes Kirk, so they haven't earned any friendship yet as an audience member from my standpoint. And all of these other people have just come together as a crew, so they haven't really served together to where I'm going to have any emotional empathy for what they're going through yet. And I really felt like you said, they were trying to hit all of these beats for the fans and say, well, this is going to happen and this is going to happen. And here's some Klingons out of nowhere. We're yeah. just going to go to the Klingon homeworld just because we didn't have Klingons in the first movie. So we want to have them in this movie. And
here's what's her name? The blonde lady. Oh, let's just have her in there. Why? Yeah. Well, you know, she could have been anybody.
Yeah. She could have been anybody. And the fact that they threw her in and had to have the scene of her and Kirk in the shuttle.
Yeah.
Getting ready to go down the planet so she could change clothes in front of him. It cracks me up to no end, because Damon Lindelof actually gave an interview where he apologized for that and said, that was a gratuitous semi-nude scene. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have done it. And my first thought was, the whole movie was gratuitous.
Yes, exactly.
Like, well, everything that happened in the movie was gratuitous. Everything. You didn't earn any of that.
Right. I've got to put, now somebody might say, oh, well, it couldn't have been anybody. She had to be Carol Marcus because she had to be the daughter of the Admiral. Well, but he was retrofitted onto her, not the other way around.
Exactly.
She was a pre-existing character. He was not.
And unless you're going to do something to plant a seed of, she's working on the Genesis device.
Yeah, yeah.
Or working on formulas or something that's going to lead to something bigger, there's no reason for her to be there. Because not only did they not use her to set that up, but Kirk didn't even have anything going on with her. Like, there was no nod other than that one gratuitous scene in the shuttle.
Yeah.
There was no byplay between the two of them that would show you that they were interested in each other romantically,
and later
or that something might develop,
and that later they have a son.
Right, exactly.
So like no David in this universe.
So it, at least not yet. I thought it was totally superfluous to have her there if you weren't going to use her properly, and she just became another token crew person, kind of like Sulu and Chekhov became in this movie.
You know who she could have been even better, probably, would be Janice Rand.
Exactly.
Just make Janice Rand a weapons expert instead of a stewardess. Kirk's stewardess, right? That's basically.
But I, you know, Right, exactly. That's what she just came up and held the clipboard for him so he could sign something every once in a while. She wasn't even the worst handle of the characters. I mean, we talked earlier about how Carl Urban was barely in this movie, which really sucks from a Star Trek standpoint, because McCoy is such a huge part of Kirk and Spock and the relationship between the three of them. And the fact that they just kind of like felt that he was disposable enough to throw away and not use in any significant way really bothered me, because it shows kind of a lack of understanding of who these characters are. But the other one that really bothered me was Scotty, because it seemed to me like with this movie, even more so than the first one, they were really playing to Simon Pegg.
Yeah.
And not so much who the character of Scotty is. And even though they've changed these characters for the reboot, I feel like Scotty's not even the same guy that he was in the original series. Like, right. I don't know who this guy is, but he's not Scotty. And you can make all of the allusions to him, you know, saving Kirk's bacon and doing stuff with the engines and saving the day as much as you want. And he's the miracle worker, but he's really become like a malcontent and has got a major problem with authority that I don't remember Scotty ever having before the reboot.
Well, what I think these characters are is they're basically cartoonish caricatures of the original characters and actors, and like I said in 2009 that worked. It was okay. They gave them a little more depth and a little more time on the screen to do those things. But in this one, it was very superficial. I felt like these were caricatures that if you compare a scene of Scotty, I could not see this Scotty sitting on the center seat on the Enterprise, you know, bluffing out the Klingons the way that the old Scotty.
Exactly. You
know, the old Scotty would sit there in the center seat and have the Klingons second-guessing themselves just by the stuff he'd say to them. I just don't see that. Let me go through a few things that I kind of how I reacted to this one. The opening scene you mentioned, it was neat, but it made absolutely no sense.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Kirk and Spock steal some scroll thing. Why? To distract these people from something that Spock is doing? Why? How would the people there know that there was something going on in their volcano? I don't have a clue. Why are they running around with it and jumping off of a cliff? Why are they leaving it in the trees? Why is the Enterprise underwater? Why can they sometimes beam people out and sometimes can't? Just the whole opening to me suffered from the main problem I had with this movie, and you touched on this a little bit, which is contrived, contrived, contrived. And this is a condition that every Damon Lindelof project that he writes has to me, is everything happens not in a logical procession of events or character-driven actions. Everything happens because it needs to happen to produce the next thing. And the next thing usually is big and flashy. And so to get the next big and flashy thing, you have to do this. The whole thing with the missiles and the frozen people inside and Khan being on the Klingon homeworld and sending the Enterprise off to shoot 72 missiles at the Klingon. That just, none of that made any sense at all. Now, somebody who really likes this movie and wants to defend it can sit down with me, and I'm sure they can walk through a logical process of how this makes perfect sense, but honestly, you're really having to force it to a large degree to make that work. And the other point I want to make, when they have Cumberbatch locked in the cell, I kept wondering if that was the same cell that Loki was locked in.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you bring that up, because I saw something where somebody had written something online about how that's become like the new big thing in movies, where you have to have a scene where your villain allows himself to be captured.
Yes.
So that he can have kind of like this verbal standoff with the hero. And
Skyfall, you know, the person, Avengers,
yeah, exactly.
Star Trek, and, yes.
And the person that wrote this was trying to figure out why that became a big thing. And I knew immediately. I X-Men, told other people,
Silence of the Lambs. Holy cow.
It's Silence of the Lambs. Everybody wants that Anthony Hopkins, Jodie Foster moment.
Wow. And I got it. I'm so proud of myself.
Yeah. The only way that they can figure out to do it is to do it in a jail cell of some kind.
Yeah.
Where they're facing each other. And my reply to that is, you know what's an even cooler way to do that? And it's only been done one time, and I don't know why more people haven't ripped it off. In the great Michael Mann movie, Heat, that was built up as like Al Pacino and Robert De Niro are finally going to be in a movie together. And they had one scene together, and it's their two characters. You know, Pacino's a cop, Robert De Niro's the bank robber, and they have one scene where they're in a diner together. And they're sitting there just kind of drinking together. And then they go their separate ways. And I think that's what people need. People are getting tired of like the villain being in a jail cell all the time.
Yeah. That was one of the things I hated about Skyfall, was the whole contrived thing where he lets himself get captured just so that he can have his laptop plugged into the MI6 thing so it can open the door and he can get back out again. That made no sense at all either. The whole thing is, that's one of the big problems I had with Skyfall. It's almost like Lindelof wrote Skyfall. I just had big problems with that.
And the thing I don't understand about all of these problems that you and I noticed in Star Trek Into Darkness was they had really good storytellers that have worked on really good TV shows and movies and done good work. You know, when you talk about Orky and Kurtzman and Lindelof and J.J. Abrams, I mean, that's four guys that worked on this, and not one of them had the brains to say, okay, this is a plot hole. So maybe we need to work our way back from this and figure out a way to explain this.
Jim, I still think about Prometheus, which if you go back to episode one of this series, you know that I like. Mark Biscuit and I both said we liked it. We enjoyed watching it, but it makes no sense at all. And I still look at Prometheus and think, how in the world did the director, help me out here.
Ridley Scott.
Yeah. How in the world did Ridley Scott look at that script and not say, wait a minute, hold on here. Because if anybody, you know, should be able to look at a script and see major problems, you'd think it would be Ridley Scott, right? But I don't understand it. I feel like with Prometheus, with Star Trek Into Darkness, with all that stuff, I feel like they looked at it and said, okay, there's 800 explosions, there's some really cool visuals, the Enterprise comes up out of the water, they shoot these two guys in spacesuits through a wreckage field to another ship, you know, you got all these cool, you got Cumberbatch jumping on these flying trains, fighting Uhura and whatnot, and Spock, oh, that all is so cool. Nobody's going to care if it doesn't make sense. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
And except for, to me, if I'm in a room with people and they're pitching those scenes to me and somebody says, you know, the being on the flying trains is an example. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a great scene. Spock loses his cool and beams down to Earth to go chasing after Khan. And they have this, you know, running gun battle that ends up on this flying train where they're beating the holy heck out of each other. And nobody can go down to help Spock.
Yeah.
I mean, they're on Earth. There's probably millions of policemen and soldiers on Earth that work for Starfleet. Nobody on the Enterprise is smart enough to pick up the phone and say, hey, they're on this train.
Yeah.
Get it to stop and surround it with a bunch of guys and shoot the taller guy.
Yes.
And even when they do something and be proactive, because, you know, I don't remember which one of the crew it is that says, well, we can't beam them up. Can we beam somebody down? Who do they send? They send Uhura. And I'm thinking to myself, you've got loads of security on the Enterprise. You can only beam one person?
And the communications.
Why don't you beam like 12 people down there?
Yeah.
Like, even if you can only beam one person at a time, just keep beaming people down there until you stop that guy.
You have to.
It's stuff like that.
You have to put your brain in neutral or you can't enjoy it.
it's funny because, you know, I know you know that I've been teaching screenwriting classes, mm-hmm. and early on in each one of the classes, we talk about outlining.
Yeah.
And I always tell my classes, you know, outlining is like one of the most important things that you can do in the process, because that's how you figure out the flow of your story, mm-hmm. and you figure out if there's any holes, or you figure out if you're getting yourself into trouble. And I always say, instead of starting at the beginning and working your way to the end, you figure out, how do I start the movie? How do I end the movie? And then you fill in the middle, mm-hmm. because if you just come up with a really cool idea and you start writing, you're going to write yourself into these plot holes and you're not going to be able to go back and fix it. Mm-hmm. If you figure out what the end is first, then you know you can work your way back and say, oh, I've got this problem. You know, I'm starting at point A and I need to get to where they have this big running gun battle. That's the climax of my movie. So how do I get them there? And how do I make sure that nobody else can get down to help Spock? And you set up all of the roadblocks ahead of time before you even start writing. And I think that's where they got into trouble, was it was just a bunch of guys in a room going, oh, wouldn't this be cool?
Exactly.
And wouldn't this be cool?
Exactly.
And, hey, and we're going to do the Wrath of Khan. So somebody's got to sacrifice themselves.
But somebody's got to yell Khan. Oh, my God. Right. Oh, no.
And
no.
let's flip it, because everybody's going to be expecting that it's going to be Spock. So let's make it Kirk this time.
Yeah.
And as soon as that happened, you know, Kirk goes to save the day and he's got to crawl up into the warp core practically to knock it back into place.
Yeah.
I knew exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, this is the second movie in a rebooted franchise. They're not killing off Kirk.
No, of course.
There's no way he's going to be dead at the end of this movie. Whereas it worked in Wrath of Khan, because think about it. When Star Trek The Motion Picture came out, it was a big hit. It justified a sequel. But nobody knew if there was going to be a third one.
Right.
Because, first of all, Leonard Nimoy said he was only doing one more. And he wasn't coming back. And second of all, the returns for Wrath of Khan were just barely what Star Trek The Motion Picture made. I mean, it wasn't like these movies were huge box office blockbusters.
Right.
So when Spock died at the end of Wrath of Khan, we were all kind of like shocked.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
And you're kind of like, wait a minute. Is he coming back? Are they going to do a third one without Spock? What's happening here?
Right.
Absolutely. If they had killed off Kirk, everybody would have known, oh, he's coming back. Like, there's no doubt. Yeah, they're not just going to have Chris Pine die. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they did these narrative things where we knew that they were going to figure out a way to come back from it. Whereas in the first one, when they did things like destroy the entire planet of Vulcan, that stunned me.
Sure.
Because I was like, wow, these guys are really playing for keeps.
Mm-hmm.
Anything could happen, because they killed Spock's mom and they destroyed his planet. So anything could happen from now on. And they kind of just wasted all that goodwill in the second movie by having things happen that we knew weren't going to stick.
Summing up, last thoughts for me, as we're running out of time, I would simply say it reminds me of when Rob Liefeld wrote the Avengers, quote-unquote, wrote the Avengers for a few issues. It's like it's written by somebody who really liked something about the original of something, but never understood why. They understood the surface, but they never really understood why. And so you get a lot of the surface flash. You get it's like almost like a Xerox copy in a way, but yet underneath the surface, it doesn't hold together, because it's almost like a greatest hits.
What do you call it?
When you run several songs together,
it's
I'll think of the word.
This is sad because we're two really smart guys and we can't think of it.
It's like a medley. It's a greatest hits medley.
It's a medley
with 50 seconds of each song, right? And so it's got a little bit of Wrath of Khan, a little bit of the 2009 track, a little bit of something else, whatever. It's got some flashing stuff that never was in Star Trek before, really, honestly. And a little bit of, Corrupt Federation, Up to No Good, a little Babylon 5 almost, all thrown together. But to me, it just didn't hold together. What is your final verdict on this? And then we're going to have to wrap up.
That's exactly how I felt about it coming out of the second movie. And I read a review where somebody said, this is like the best fan fiction that any... And somebody spent, $150 million on it.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt like that. It was kind of like, somebody sat down and they said, this is what I like about Star Trek.
Uh-huh.
And I want to bring in all these different pieces of it. And it doesn't make any sense. There's no coherence to it. And the next time you and I get together face to face, I will pitch to you my sequel to the Star Trek reboot, because I don't want to do it out in public.
Awesome.
Because I really like the idea that I might be able to do the third or fourth one if I can get my foot in the door. And this is a great movie. But it has all those touchstones, and yet it takes advantage of the rebooted universe. And that's not what they did here.
Right.
They could have done anything because they hit the reset button in the best way possible, and they totally squandered that with this movie.
Yep. All right. So we give the 2009 one a thumbs up, and the Into Darkness, sort of Into Obscurity, hopefully, kind of a swing and a miss, squandered opportunities, really flashy fan fiction, but not really Star Trek.
It did actually break the curse, because
that's true.
The even numbered, odd numbered curse is flip flopped now.
Yes.
So that's now, right. I guess now we have odd numbered tracks are going to be the good ones from here on out.
How about that? Jim, thank you so much. What have you got going on right now, and how can people find you?
They can check out stuff, the rebooted Midnight Entertainment website will probably be online in a couple of weeks. It's midnight-entertainment.com.
Awesome.
We've got the first volume of Extraordinary, which is our superhero series, is going to be coming out in October. And probably by the time we get around to doing the DC Universe movie show, I might have news about directing a stage version of Sherlock Holmes. So
cool.
I've got a lot of stuff going on.
Awesome, awesome. So the new stuff, is that going to be comics, novels, anthologies? How are you doing it?
It's going to be novels. Okay. Actually, it's more of a an anthology sort of thing, because once I get past the first one, which is kind of like the pilot episode of a TV series, so it's a little longer, each volume after that is actually going to have three stories in it.
Very good. It's
more episodic. So.
Right. Awesome. Well, we can't wait to see that. That's awesome. All right. Well, tell them how. Yeah, so midnight-entertainment.com,
yep.
And you can look for you. They can look for you on Facebook, I assume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on the revamp website in a couple of weeks, we'll have all Facebook and Twitter and all that jazz. So.
Awesome. Jim, thanks so much for coming on board today. Another great show. I'm looking forward to talking to DC Cinematic Universe with you in a little ways down the line. And our time is up. And as always, folks, we thank you for yours. It's time for the rocket to get on out of here. So we will see you all down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.